It's also not 10 grilled puffin recipes by Alan Cox. But more significantly, it's not this title. I'm not a memory management kind of guy. I have not written any of the memory management code that's in the PA-RISC Linux kernel. Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, why don't I just adjust the browser? So I can't answer any questions that are very low level or deep into the PA-RISC memory management and caching, which tends to be a little bit complex. And also, an hour and a half really isn't enough to go into it. So I want you to just be cautious about that. The stuff I will talk about is give an overview of how the port is going, sort of some of the issues in dealing with HP, give you an overview of the hardware, but really you're, I hope you're not expecting an in-depth optimization kind of talk at the level that Dave Miller would give. So stuff I want to talk about. How we got started in this, which is a bit of an unusual story. Give you an overview of the hardware that we're working with. Talk about some of the development problems and some of the successes. There's a few things that we really had problems with in areas that I don't think other architectures have, which makes us a bit of a unique port. Also want to talk about how much we've done, what's up next. I'll give a demonstration of the machine booting, assuming it works. It was transported in the rain yesterday, so we'll have to make sure that's okay. And then I'll take questions. And there will be a test at the end. So what is Linux for PA-RISC? Well, really, all it is just the regular Linux kernel that we all know and love running on HP hardware. Really, PA-RISC is the last architecture to run Linux. In terms of machines that were distributed widely. The number of HPs out there, PA-RISC boxes, is significant. And really, it's a bit of a shame that this wasn't addressed earlier. There have been a couple of other open source projects to getting a new operating system running on PA-RISC. The native operating system is HPUX, and we've all had a little bit of fun with HPUX, and the more we use it, the more we really want Linux. I'll get into it as to why we have to use HPX for the development of this. There's been two really significant operating systems that were ports were started. One is OpenBSD, and we've been able to look at some of their code, but because of licensing problems with the BSD license, we're not able to just take code and copy it right into the Linux kernel, which really means that we can only use it as reference. Another one that is a little bit further along, and but still very, very much a development project, is MKLinux, which is the mock. What it is the Linux kernel with some mock kind of splicings on it, and the external, sort of the device drivers that are in it are actually part of mock, not the Linux kernel. So the licensing there all comes from OSF, which is pure hell. So we can't borrow any of the code from there either. All we can do is use it as reference too. Neither of these ports they really haven't had any progress in the last year or so. We've been able to borrow a couple of things, and it turns out that the things that we have borrowed in terms of development tools has only kind of slowed us down. I'll get into that a little bit more. So what this is monolithic Linux, and we're intending to that our developments will actually be merged into the mainstream source tree, so that everyone who runs PA-RISC Linux can take advantage of all the features that are added into the kernel and already exist in it. Being able to merge your trees back in, your development tree back into Linux's mainstream kernel is really helpful. That'll happen no matter what. It won't take this. So just to give you a history of it, most of these things start with a couple of people saying to themselves, I need something cool to work on. And I already have this much background in whatever hardware, whatever software it is they're working in, and I really want to do another project. This wasn't really like that. How it started was in Atlanta. There was a group of us. And the Atlanta conference was a little bit like this, but bigger and in a worse city. And it was there wasn't really a lot to do except for talk, and the people there were great. And we're sitting in this really kind of cruddy food court, the best sort of dining we could find. And there are a group of us sort of going through the different architectures that we'd worked on, and we started listing them. And so, you know, we started off with, you know, MIPS and M68K and started talking about the VAX port and things like that. And the more we talked, the more we realized that it was easier to list the hardware that it didn't run on. Now, just last night, a group of us went through and developed that list again, and it's we came up with really only one or two left. But the big one that stood out was PA RISC. Now, at that table, there was no one who had ever done any PA RISC Linux development, or I'm sorry, PA RISC development. So really, the people there didn't understand a lot of the issues with the CPU. That would prove to be an interesting thing. If you look at Spark Linux or SGI Linux, those started from people who had a prior experience with that CPU's specific features. So that was quite a deciding thing. The only time I'd ever used HP and PA RISC was in my days when I worked at Nortel BNR, when I used HPUX there. But really, I had no idea about what the hardware was like, and I didn't get into any of the somewhat hellish HPUX system administration. So how it started was there was a group of us, and we said, we need a new project. Let's do PA RISC Linux. And we didn't even really know that it was called PA RISC. There's been some confusion over the name, if it's HPPA or PA RISC. And we flopped on it twice, and we're back to PA RISC now again. So we said we were going to do this, and we had no idea of what we were getting ourselves into. We expected the problems to be in places they really weren't. And new problems cropped up in places we hadn't expected. So the group of us decided to go on and do this, and we had no hardware. Really, none of us owned PA RISC hardware, except for one guy by the name of Travis Melheiser, who lives in North Carolina. And he said, oh, sure, I got lots of equipment. I'll send you a box. So through some creative shipping that involved mailing about 100 pounds of hardware from North Carolina to Ottawa, I got a PA RISC box, my first 715, which is really cool. And I thought, great, I'm going to start on this today, until I realized that the video cable was going to take another 2 months to get. So even though the idea was thought of in October and I had hardware in November or something, really we weren't able to do anything until starting in January. That's when we really started getting the cross-compiler, having a look at what it was like, and we sort of got, you know, some cross-compiling RPM started, that sort of thing. And it looked like we were kind of ready to go. You know, we got a kernel tree sort of set up in CVS and found someone to host that kind of thing. And then, so we had announced this sort of on mailing lists and in I guess, Slashdot, things like that. And at some point, HP gives us a call. And we were doing this with the help of the Puffin Group, who I was employed with at the time. And Chris and I, Chris Beard, at some point answered the phone, and there was HP on the other line saying, hey, we heard about your port. We're somewhat interested in it. What can you tell us? So Chris said, all right, we'll set up a meeting. So we end up with this, I think, like an hour and a half long distance phone call, conferenced in with about six different senior engineers at HP. And the people there were really interesting. We got a clear sense of how serious they were about this. The people we talked to were senior engineers, head of HPUX, a lot of people with different hardware experience, HP marketing, which proved to be a very significant part of the help we got. So we said, okay, let's do this. And it was a little bit quite exciting knowing that we were going to be able to get the help that we needed from HP. The initial plan was to be able to do all this work with no documentation, being able to reference the MK and MK Linux and NetBSD source code and poking around a lot. And it sounds like a terrible thing to get into, but the success of Mac Linux really proved to us that it was possible in some ways. And we suspected that the HP internal hardware wouldn't be as bad as Steve Wozniak's attempts at artistry. So this is how we had started. So really, encountering documentation and encountering support from HP really hadn't been the plan. That little exit thing didn't work, Dave. So this is how it went, and suddenly it became so much of a different kind of project because we knew how bigger it was getting. Getting support from a hardware manufacturer vendor is really an important thing. My experiences with SGI Linux really proved that. In March, we went to Linux World Expo to announce all this, and we got a lot of press coverage about Linux for PA Risk, and we were printed in newspapers that where the target audience certainly wouldn't know what Linux or PA Risk was. So it was a very interesting time. We got some great questions at the time, and I'll go through some of them at the very end. So we were sort of getting development started. We got a box from HP at some point, this very large thing that has never run Linux and won't for a few months now. And we talked to HP about what we needed. And actually, that's in another slide. At some point, Jason Eckert, who did have prior development experience with PA Risk, got a bootloader running, which was, I would say, very exciting because we had something that would you would turn the computer on, it would boot and print Linux, which we were all thrilled with. It was hard to tell if we could qualify that as the first monolithic Linux running on PA Risk. That was probably a stretch, but that's what the press picked up. At some point, we got a kernel tree in there, and we got it booting. Building, and getting it building is a real pain. There's a lot of different bits to tweak just to be able to get it to compile once. And at some point, we got a binary called VM Linux, and it was 660 meg of pure crud, right? But we were very happy at that point. Then a little bit later, a couple months later, we got a kernel actually booting. And here's how it went. We got a bootloader sort of set up. I'll talk about the details a little bit later. We got a bootloader that would actually pull a kernel off a disk, load it into memory, and then jump into it. And that was accumulation of a lot of people's contributions there. A lot of people had different ideas on how to do it, but we came up with a solution that did work. So the kernel actually booted and died flat out right away, and there was rejoicing internationally. This was a monumental event. Never again will we be that happy at seeing a kernel crash. Over the last month, so my notes are a little bit vague on this, but we got a lot of different things. Philip Rumpf really got a lot of interruption work going. We got to the point of being able to calibrate a delay loop, interval timers. We got the start of a couple of device drivers going. I'll show you later in the demo. You'll be able to see some of them load up, hopefully. So working with HP, HP's real motivation in this was to be able to sell more hardware, I'm convinced. So it's quite a bit different because PA Risk was really used to sell HPUX quite a bit. So it presented a bit of a different marketing model for them. I don't pretend to speak on behalf of HP, but I can let you know what it was like from our side. So they helped us out by giving us hardware. Now, a lot of people say, yay, free hardware, isn't that great? But at some point, there's just too much free hardware, and you have to move to be able to store it all. So it's maybe not as good as you think it is. However, getting a consistent set of hardware across the board was really important. So we worked with HP to decide which hardware it was going to be. And they had their ideas at the start. And they were thinking, oh, we got these great 64-bit, 8-way processor things, 2 gigs of RAM, terabytes of disk space. We want those to run Linux. We think that would be great. And Chris and I looked at each other and said, well, I'm not sure my floor can hold that much, and the electricity bills will be high. So why don't we look at something a little bit smaller? So we got this thing. This is an A1 ADC, which is a big name for a small box. And it's a 32, I'll go through some of the specs a bit later. So getting the hardware to developers was pretty significant. HP sent 10 machines out to different developers at the start and managed to get another 2 boxes kind of on emergency notice because it really helped the port at the time. The other thing we got is I'll just give you an idea about the documentation. Previously, none of the document hardware specs had been released publicly. So it was very important for us to be able to have access to these hardware manuals. It was I wouldn't say it is always the documents have just kind of ended up on our doorsteps. We've had to sort of guide HP into telling them what priorities, what things to release first, what documents we really needed in the future. All of that sort of process and that dialogue with HP, I think, has really worked out well. I'm not just saying that because they're here. I would say that if they weren't. Another thing is that as the documentation was being released, we got quite a bit of email from the hardware engineers who had designed those components themselves. And these people were really interested in helping us out. They knew where the flaws were that were undocumented. They understood how the startup code and init code for these devices worked in within HPUX and could give us guidance based on their past experiences. Often there's a lot of things that are not written in documents anywhere. So that kind of experience was invaluable and continues to be. I'll tell you a little bit about PA Risk machines. There's sort of this cluster of machines. There are actually quite a few of them in the world. I don't have numbers. We're looking at about 135 different models of machines. Now, it might sound like a lot, but it's actually pretty good because what it means is that we have a finite number of combinations of hardware arrangements. You have this problem with PCs. You have, okay, you can't use this Ethernet card and this SCSI controller or you'll have problems, right? There's an infinite number of combinations in PCs. So just being able to know that, okay, if you have a 712 and you have exactly this list of components, we expect it's going to make things really easy. And really, we can just have this list of 135 boxes and just start scratching them off one at a time. The intention is really to support, I think, about 110 of those boxes. There are some problems with some of the old machines and early CPUs, and the number that are actually out there isn't significant. There's quite a bit of custom hardware in these things, too, which makes it a bit creative. It looks really custom when you look at it until you open the books of the documentation. And then you discover some interesting secrets that HP has not advertised, and that's that a lot of the components are actually stock things that we've seen in other places. We have different buses in there. There's things like HSC and GSC. There's actually quite a few machines with GPIB or HPIB. They're about the same thing, I think. A lot of custom buses that we're going to have to deal with, things that you never would have seen. On the other hand, things have been sort of moving towards EISA and PCI in the last couple of years. So that's expected to make life quite a bit simpler. Still remain quite a few undocumented machines in this list. It isn't easy always for a hardware company to just dig out documentation. They have it, but in a company the size of Hewlett Packard, it's difficult just to come up with that documentation quickly. They've committed, though, to releasing documentation for a certain set of machines. One second. In releasing this documentation, we discovered quite a few interesting things. So really what we had to do is decide on what machines we wanted to port to. So HP really wanted us to do work on modern hardware. At the same time, what the Puffin group was worried about was making sure that the developers all had a base level of hardware that was identical for all the machines. It becomes very difficult when you have a lot of varying factors and you don't understand why your kernel will work on one machine but not another. Having everyone have the same set of problems means they'll get tackled quicker. So we were guiding towards a machine that would be easy to find just on the free market. There's a lot of hardware just kind of floating around. People are giving away boxes. People, you know, they upgrade the machine and they get rid of their old junk, and that ends up in some developer's basement or closet. Really being able to address those machines was important. It seems to me, this is without formal statistical analysis, that by far the most prevalent machine out there was the Gecko. Some people call it Snakes as well. It has a few other code names. And this is a really small box. I wish I had brought it because it's kind of cute inside. I'm told there was one coming to me, but I guess U.S.-Canada shipping isn't as good as the U.S.-Swiss to Germany transportation of 712s. There's a good inside story there. This is Matt Wilcox, our transportation specialist. He's done quite well. Not sure what else he's going to be smuggling home with him this trip. Being able to target the 712s was important. There's a few things. The first thing is having a lot of machines out there means that there's going to be more people to try and use your stuff. And getting a base install, a large enough population who has access to the machine to try our kernels is important. The next thing is that in that subset of people who own them and want to run Linux, there will be a very small portion who will become good kernel developers. So being able to spread that wide and far was really important. However, the 712s are not currently on the market, new from HP. So HP really wanted us to target this guy. Now, the A180 is a bit of a, it's really intended for the server market. It doesn't have a few things, which is really good about it. The 712 is actually a graphical workstation, and we want to avoid that for a couple of reasons. Graphics tend to just distract people. I'm not saying anything bad about GNOME or X or anything like that. It's just when you're trying to get a kernel going, you don't want to have to deal or have a lot of kernel developers concentrating their time on graphics hardware, fast frame buffers, things like that. So we really wanted to avoid a graphical workstation if at all possible. I want to just mention something else about releasing documentation. There's a lot of people who say, a lot of kernel developers come to us and say, okay, we really need the documentation on this. Can you get it for me tomorrow? And that's just totally unrealistic with a company the size of HP. This is not a problem only found within HP. It's come up in a couple of other projects I've worked on. A great one is Silicon Graphics. Silicon Graphics Linux, the documents themselves are actually photocopied. They have lost all electronic versions of the documents. It looks like there may never have been some because it looks like it was typed on an IBM Selectric or something. And what it has like addresses and memory maps and things like that, and it has addresses scratched out in pen and overwritten. There's a portion where the address is circled and said, this is wrong, and no indication of what the real value might be. There's part where someone has a photocopying, a post-it note on top of the photocopy so you can't see the text behind it. That end, we're always stuck with having to photocopy stuff when we want to pass the documentation to other developers. As well, the limitation on that documentation, the license on it, from SGI indicates that we can't pass it on to other developers without their permission. So it's not a freely available document. The license that HP has released the documentation to us is that we can distribute it to anyone openly, freely. So we have a website that lists all the documentation that's available for this port. And you can just download their PDF PostScript files, sometimes a collection of text files, things like that. They tend to be pretty up-to-date, and there seems to be really one full-time guy, and all he's doing is reading documentation, removing things like names, and being able to license it and release a public version of the document. Sometimes in the documents, really all we need is understanding the hardware interfaces to the devices on the machine. So we often don't need to know a lot about the internals of the software device drivers that are often attached to the same document. So all that has to be stripped out before it can be released to us. I would say that by us guiding HP and telling them what documents to release first and which ones to work on next, we've been able to get the right documents at the right time. For instance, we're just getting into memory management right now, and so we said to HP, okay, we need to start thinking about CPU-specific implementations and certain problems with MMUs on certain CPUs, and they were very good at releasing documents. There have been a couple of cases where it sounded like there was some internal politics in HP, but those have been overcome reasonably well. HP decided on this A180, and it's quite similar to the 712. I'll talk a little bit about it. This is a PA-RISC 1.1 series. There are really three types of CPUs in PA-RISC. There's the 1.0, which are pretty much dead, and I don't think we're ever going to touch. It's really hard to find them. They've all been crushed or recycled for their metals. This thing has a 1.1, and 1.1 PA-RISC is a 32-bit CPU, which maps in quite well with some of the other CPUs that are supported under Linux. It's a 7300LC, which means nothing. Let's see, this one runs at 180 megahertz, but I think that one goes up into the 300s. This is a RISC-based processor, one instruction per cycle, 32-bit instructions. It actually seems to be pretty fast for the clock speed. I wouldn't judge this as a slow machine just on the clock speed alone. Really, all this thing is three chips inside. If you open it up, all you will see is three significant chips. There is Lassie, and Lassie is a super I/O controller that handles things like SCSI and SCSI on this thing. It also has, well, I'll talk about it in more detail, it really handles all the peripheral components. There's also a Dino PCI controller. So there's a PCI bus on this thing that has one device internal, the Ethernet chip, which is a tulip. And then sitting off there's two PCI slots in there as well. Coming off the PA-RISC 1.1 CPUs is a bus called GSC. If you look in the documents, it's actually referenced to expand to a couple of different things. I think it's actually a Gecko system connector. So it's just the internal, kind of a local bus that comes right off the CPU. So Lassie and Dino actually sit on the Gecko bus, the GSC. This means because GSC is only implemented in HP, within PA-RISC stuff, it means that we have never seen any Gecko buses before in our life on any other architectures. So that Dino and Lassie only exist in PA-RISC. So we really have to write those from scratch. You will see, though, soon enough that it's not quite as bad as it sounds. Another thing that's in this thing is because it's meant for ISPs and servers, it has consoles at the back that you can connect to. And now, we all love serial console whenever you can find the right cable. But HP decided to go one step further, and there's a second Ethernet port at the back. And in fact, if you look inside, you can see a little embedded M68K computer in there. And what you can do is connect with a web browser running a little Java console within your web browser. It is just amazingly painful, though. If you can avoid this, it's better. It means that you need to have run Java to be able to run a terminal program. Now, in my mind, a terminal program is like a less than a meg kind of application. Running it this way makes it into about a 10 meg application, and you have to run all of Java, and running that is just a huge hog. So really, we've been trying to work our way around this. Later versions of this web console actually let you telnet to that Ethernet port. And what this really does is just give you access to a system console. I'll try and load it up later, but it's a bit flaky. It does work, but it's amazingly slow. The other thing is that it actually gives you your console within a Netscape window, and then you still can't cut and paste the text that's within that console into it, like a, I don't know, VI or whatever, to be able to mail out boot sequences, things like that. Very difficult. I guess you could do it if you just grabbed the image and then ran some sort of OCR program on it. But we decided that we wanted to do kernel developing instead. Far simpler. So this thing has web console, but it also has serial console, which I've only used yesterday for the first time. It does seem to work once you know what cable to get. Mike Shaver has a collection of about 80 different serial console cables that he tried for his SGI, never got one working. So you end up with weird things, like it'll print stuff, but you can't type, or it prints, and then every once in a while you get the stream of funny characters coming by. So it's been a bit of a pain finding the right serial settings. And I have to say, the documentation we've gotten from HP directly is very good. Finding it on the website is pretty close to impossible. So we've really been trying to avoid the Java web console, even though a lot of people at HP have really encouraged us to use it. The A180 is really, using these kind of three components, the CPU, Lassie, and Dino. If you look through the family tree of HPs, which is difficult to discover, you'll notice a certain line of them all have Lassie. Another certain line of them all have Dino. And what you can really do is, just by being able to support those two graphics or those two I/O controllers, you can really support a large number of PA-RISC models that are out there. And it relates a lot to 712. Really, the A180 is just like a 712 with some of the stuff removed from Lassie and allocated to Dino. But really, they will run the same kernel in the end. That makes development pretty interesting, and it was unclear that this really existed until we got into development a little bit. So I think we did pretty well in sort of planning what hardware we were going to target, but it wasn't. Some of that was a bit of a fluke. There's also been some misinformation. Some people think that Lassie exists on all 700 series machines, but that simply isn't true, as we're finding out. This thing has no graphics. That's all I'm going to say. It does have a PCI slot, so actually you could put an S3 or something in there and hook a VGA monitor up, and everything will be just fine. The reason that we coaxed Alan Cox into this is because we challenged him with running a TV card and a PCI card in this thing and actually watching TV on your PA-RISC box, which I'm sure no one in the world has ever done before. He hasn't gotten there yet, so we're a little bit disappointed with his progress. It will happen, though. So one of the great things is, right, in the Linux kernel tree, you have all these device drivers for different PCI devices. Once you have PCI going, you can use all those device drivers. And quite frankly, the number of PCI cards that we can support, different components, is much greater than HPUX has ever had. I think we're going to do quite well in that way. We do also have, however, having to deal with things like GSC cards and HSC cards. That's going to be a little bit complicated in the future. So we got this cross-compiler set going, and we're thinking, this is great. It builds almost right out of the box. I have to spend about a week sorting out bin utils, configure scripts, and things like that. But I actually got a cross-compiler that would target PA-RISC Linux. There is already existing PA-RISC or HPPA code to produce HPPA code assembler, I guess, within GCC. And bin utils could sort of link it. We noticed quite a few problems sort of starting up, though. Let me just give an overview of this problem, because this has really been a significant part of the development. Cross-compiling with the GNU bin utils and GCC is very difficult, and we gave up. This problem is going to be solved by Cygnus in the end. I'll go through all this problem right now. So in this cross-compiler that I was building, what it was is those tools had been extracted from the NetBSD port. OpenBSD and actually MK Linux as well. And it sort of worked. It seemed to produce a binary. And you did a file on it, and it would actually tell you that it was HPPA 1.1 executable in ELF32 format. However, in going through it a little bit, we noticed some real problems in building a kernel. The linker would segfault, it would die, it would produce huge files, sparse files, a couple of meg large. So I knew that there were real problems with it. And investigating further and sort of talking about these on a mailing list, we discovered that really this was terrible code to be dealing with. The ELF we couldn't find documents that described this ELF implementation that OpenBSD and MK Linux had used. Normally, what you do in a situation where you're porting to a new architecture is you find the existing Unix that runs and you use their object loading format. However, we started looking at HPUXs. HPUX uses something called SOM. SOM goes back quite a long ways and is sort of a weird modification of an ELF version. And we were after a 32-bit implementation, obviously. That'll be significant a bit later. We were looking for documents that described, OpenBSD's ELF, and we were looking around at HP to see their documents on SOM, and there were nothing the same at all. SOM is actually a spectrum object model, and just object model. Yeah, let's go for that. And we didn't understand, why it was different from ELF, but it goes back so far before the line was actually called PA-RISC. I guess the code name or the original marketing name for PA-RISC was Spectrum. So we realized soon enough that we didn't want to start writing SOM tools. I'll get into why that is. As for the old ELF32 implementation we had, the authors, Jeff Law and Mike Hibbler, both told us that we were nuts if we were going to proceed that way. They said, just abandon our code. We never want to see it again. We have great nightmares over it. We don't ever want to see it. So we gave up. We just gave up flat on the existing bin utils and GCC modifications for HPPA or PA-RISC. So then we started looking at SOM, and we said, okay, we'll just build a SOM linker to be able to build our kernel with. We already had some sort of basic SOM building in GCC. So we thought this would work out just fine, except then Jeff Law. Now, I hope you understand who Jeff Law is. Jeff Law is really the backbone of a lot of Cygnus's development efforts with GCC and bin utils. He also has an amazing amount of PA-RISC experience. He comes from the University of Utah. Well, it's not where he was born, but it seems like it. And he understands PA-RISC intimately because of their involvement with mock and PA-RISC. And he told us that it would take him 9 months to implement a linker that would be able to do SOM properly. And really, we were better off looking at HP's version. So we kind of gawked at this, and we really didn't want to have to use a closed-source linker. There's a few reasons for this, especially when that would only run on HPUX. So we had to give up on being able to use the GNU bin utils as our linker. So then we started talking a little bit, and at some point HP announced that HP was going to hire Cygnus to do a bit of development work. The details of this have not been released, so I can't talk about them. But what has been released is that Cygnus will work on HP's behalf to produce a 60-bit version of PA-RISC ELF. It's really intended for HPUX, though. It's not intended for Linux. However, just knowing that there is going to be an implementation of a proper version of 64-bit ELF for PA-RISC is really going to help us. Okay, so let's go back to the CPU versions. There's two main ones that we're targeting, two modern versions of PA-RISC, 1.1, 2.0. 1.1 is 32-bit, 2.0 is 64-bit. If you run HPUX, it runs this mixture of SOM stuff for the 32-bit versions, which we're targeting, and it also runs some 64-bit ELF stuff on the 64-bit processors. So this combination led us to believe that there was some hope of running ELF. We dug a bit deeper into the documentation. We actually found the author who set out the specification for 64-bit ELF, and he said, actually, I have a 32-bit implementation for ELF. We've just never implemented it. So we got the documents, we looked at them side by side, and we noticed, hey, there's a lot of similarity between the two. All we need to do is go through the 64-bit implementation, backtrack it, and make some changes for the 32-bit. For the most part, we expect we can use most of the code. We looked at it and said, that's a really big deal. We looked around, there wasn't anyone who had a lot of prior ELF experience. Not many people do. And we knew that Cygnus was going to produce something good in the end. So our attitude was, let's just wait until they release their 64-bit implementation. Unfortunately, it's been a bit difficult because I can't announce when that will be, although the Puffin Group knows. We have to wait until HP or Cygnus will announce the release date. There's been rumors of the fall, though. That's all I can say. So we knew that this was going to be able to help us out. However, we didn't really want to wait until the fall or whenever they were going to release their 64-bit implementation and just kind of sit down and not do anything. So it was really important for us to be able to, you know, do a little bit, do some work in the meantime. So we came up with a temporary solution and a different font, I'm just noticing. The solution was, let's drop ELF. Let's use the existing linker and development environment that exists under HPUX. Okay, so what this really was, we're only using the linker that exists on HPUX. We're still going to be using the GNU GCC to actually be able to generate the assembler that will be passed, or the object formats that will be passed to the linker, but in the end we'll rely on the linker to link our kernel. This is a real pain. It means that you actually have to do all your development in HPUX. So it means that either you have one machine you build, and then to be able to test your kernel you have to reboot the same machine. That becomes very tiresome, and you're always near the power switch, and it tends to be a bit of a headache. It also means that you're limited by the PA-RISC box that you actually have in its speed. And a lot of people have older 712s and things like that, and it's just, you know, painful to build kernels with, you know, minute changes all the time and having to reboot. Cross-compiling, being able to actually build your kernel on an i386 box or alpha or whatever you want, whatever, you know, MIPS, VAX, whatever, really lets you use the fastest hardware you have access to. And in some cases, you know, people's Palm Pilots are faster than the PA-RISC boxes they have. So cross-compiling is really, really helpful. So we were out of that, though. Had to build on HPUX. Either had to have one machine that you always power cycled and rebooted all the time, or the other thing you could do was have two machines, have a fast machine, have a slow machine, and use, you know, your slow machine to actually test your kernels on. Finding one HP is not too difficult. Finding two is a little bit more difficult. So we've had some problems with this, and we started working on solutions where we'd set up a PA-RISC box, an HPUX box at HP, and people would actually be able to build their kernels there, download them, test them locally, until we realized that most of the people who were doing development were Europeans and suffering with 28 modems, and just transferring the kernels would be too difficult. So it seemed like a good idea at the time, and really wasn't the right sort of implementation. The other thing is that it required us to do all our work in HPUX. We are all Linux users, all the developers are, and, you know, having to suffer through HPUX was a little bit frustrating. It really took, you know, a couple of weeks to get started once you got your HPUX box. I still have not figured out how to set up my route table properly, so I always have to do it manually whenever I reboot. Fortunately, we have one person who works with us, who is able to sort of guide us through this, but hasn't been the easiest process. Being able to abandon HPUX and go to a cross-compiling model is something we're really looking for. At the same time, though, having to use HPUX and suffering through it has been good, because what it does is it motivates Linux developers to work harder to get Linux going on it, so they'll never have to see stupid HPUX ever again. It's been a great motivator. Every time someone has to figure out where GMake is and why the path isn't set or why Bash won't build, whatever, we always come back with that line. So just to talk a bit about the other devices that exist. So you have the GSC bus, which is a local bus coming right off the CPU. Then you have Dino, and they have these cute names for all these different components. And actually, if you read the Dino doc, it has a nice little dinosaur on the front page. I'm sure that was a violation of some sort of copyright, but I'm not going to tell. What it is is just a chip that has a PCI bus coming off it. It does all the translations and everything, and we have great specifications. So being able to actually use Dino properly doesn't look like too much of a problem. We have the start of Dino code. Alan started it in a bit of a weird fashion, and I did a bit of work on it, so that it seems to actually detect that there is a Dino on the bus. It's completely custom. There's nothing like it in anything else but PA-RISC. It's something we have to do from scratch. The next thing is Lassie. Again, has a dog in the front page of the documentation. This is just a collection of existing things we've seen before. There's a few exceptions. Okay. So let me take a drink of water here. It has coming off it a SCSI controller, which is an NCR53C710. We've all heard of it. The NCR line of SCSI controllers is pretty popular in all sorts of things, really. It exists in Amigas, Ataris, although not this specific version. The device driver has been implemented for, I think it is Motorola's MVM 68K machines. They have that kind of controller on board. So there is a device driver already for it. It has existed in some, I think, ISA controllers for PCs. But in any case, we have the basis for a driver for it. It also has on it an Intel Ethernet controller, which is the same thing that exists on, I think, EE Pro, the very popular, somewhat cruddy Intel Ethernet cards. Excuse me. That's only a 10 megabit implementation, though, that exists on Lassie. The next thing is a parallel port, which is not a big deal. It's exactly the same thing that we have drivers for. Serial port is really something we already have. The keyboard and mouse looks about the same as stuff we have. The real-time clock is actually custom, but the interface for it is so simple, it's not a problem. Flash EEPROM that actually stores like BIOS configuration and things like, well, just kind of BIOS on crack, but I'll get to that. There's power controls here, you can just shut down your machine using it, although that portion of the documents requires some fleshing out. There's a floppy drive on the chip as well, which we've all seen. And there's a custom telephone and audio controller, and even to get into ISDN and things like that. We don't really care about running audio on a server, and neither did HP. So there's all these devices that actually exist on this macro cell, but a lot of them have just been disconnected. The wires go nowhere. So you can actually see the devices, but they don't actually lead to a device. And if you look at the way that the A180 was implemented, there's just only a few of these things are implemented. The SCSI controller is used. The LAN is not. There's a different Ethernet controller that's used to be able to get 100 megabits. There's no parallel port, I don't think. Never seen one. I have to check. Serial port does work, and it goes to the web console or the other line we have. Quit yawning. There's no keyboard or mouse because this is a server. Real-time clock is this flash EEPROM. Power does work. There's no floppy drive on this thing, thank God. So really, there's only a portion of these things. However, if you go over to the 712, what you'll see is a Lassie implementation that has all of this. It's too bad I don't have a 712 because it's a really cute box. You open it up. It's really thin. It's just a little pizza box thing. And you open it up. Terrible. Opening up is really difficult because it opens funny, but you're not supposed to anyway. If you take it out, it's this little board about this big, and it's double-sided. On one side, you'll see this big CPU like that. On the other side, you'll see this big Lassie controller, and that's it. A lot of wires, nothing else. So all the 712 is a PA-RISC CPU, 7100LC, and a Lassie implementation. So really, it's a very simple design. So once you get Lassie going, you really get all of 712. However, for the A180, we only need a certain portion. And at this point, the immediate goal is to get to a prompt to be able to do more work on the machine. So we are only going to target the certain drivers and controllers within Lassie that are important for the A180 to start. After that, we'll backtrack and fill in the ones for the 712. Now, let me tell you about PDC. PDC is a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's processor-dependent code, although we think it stands for pretty damn cool. There's also something called IODC that interacts with. I'll tell you what it is. IODC and PDC are the set of libraries that exist in the hardware. It's actually in some sort of ROM or something. I don't know what component actually exists on the motherboard. And what it lets you do is it has base code for setting up certain peripherals. This is very useful because if you look at all the 135 different machines, they all implement a version of PDC, and the interface between the operating system and the hardware, you can just go through PDC in a standard way. The interface is always the same. So for instance, there's a call called PDC_model. You just query it, and it will spit back to you what model you're running the kernel on. You can just query the hardware. You can also do things like set up serial ports, actually print stuff back to the screen. You can flash the LEDs, which is really critical. You can actually retrieve a file from disk, just a byte stream, see what kind of machine it is, that kind of thing. Immensely useful. If you look at something like the port for Linux to M68K Mac or PowerPC Mac, things like that, or SGI Indy is a good one too. Just being able to spit something back to a serial controller, to a serial port, or display something on the screen is so immensely difficult. So you boot your kernel, it dies, and you have no idea why, and you have no way of sending debug information out. That's what slows down a lot of ports and makes it very difficult for things to get started. We don't have that problem at all. We have an implementation of putc, which just puts a character on the screen that is 3 lines long and works right away. Very easy to debug, very easy to get going, really works right away, which means right from day one, our bootloader was able to display stuff onto the screen. We don't have to deal with initialization of devices. All that's done for us in hardware. Another thing PDC will let you do is be able to query the system to see what devices actually exist in what slots. It does it in a generic way. So if you have an EISA bus and a PCI bus and a GSC one, you can just do one call and it'll give you the list of all the buses that exist and all the cards that are in it. PDC is by far the smartest thing that HP has done on the PA RISC machine. It's really helped us a lot. We don't know who they are, but we're going to send them puffins if we ever find them. Not real ones. So where we are now? Well, right now we have the bootstrap code written. It first started out as being a bootloader, which was separated from the kernel, and then we kind of grafted that into the kernel to make a bootstrap code. It worked for a while until someone else worked on it other than me, and we got it to actually load a kernel. So what it does is we figured out how the bootloader sequence worked in PA-RISC, and it was simple enough that we didn't need documentation to get that going. And then we just got to load the kernel into memory, set up some things about where in memory it would map into, and then actually jump into it and start executing. At some point, it was a bit like jumping off a cliff. You'd jump off and nothing would happen and you'd die. So it took us a while to sort of get over that, but at some point we really did boot a real kernel. We've got interruptions and interrupt support going for hardware and all sorts of other things to use interruptions for, including interval timer, which is I'll show you a bit later. We've also started on virtual memory support and memory mapping, although that's really in its infancy, and we're still sort of theorizing about how to handle things. So what's next? Well, we've got to finish virtual memory. The next thing is that we're going to just skip this, going to the network to be able to load up a root file system to be able to get to a prompt. What we're going to do is actually get a RAM disk tacked onto the end and just load it into memory, pretend that's a file system, and boom, there you go. So we don't really need Dino and Lassie going right away to get to a prompt. We really need some sort of memory mapping to be able to solve this, though. We're starting to look into that a little bit more. Full Dino and Lassie device driver implementations. Right now we have Dino going, and we have Dino going to the point where it identifies things, sets up interrupts, that kind of thing. We have a start of Lassie, but really haven't looked into actually getting to do something productive. We have this L32 task of taking the L64, merging it back, actually being able to produce new build tools. The other side of it is you need L32 to actually run a userland application. So we're going to get started in that as well. Right now we actually do have a SOM object format loader, though, so it will be possible for us to run executables that are in SOM format. Glibc, have to do that for PaRest. That's never been done before. It looks interesting. And after that, a distribution, x386, and then the world, I guess. So thanks. People who have worked to be able to make this a go, Chris Beard for not laughing at me when I suggest that the Puffin Group do this as a serious project, Alan Cox for getting us going with things like Lassie, Dino, talking to us about why lack of cache coherency was going to be a problem, really explaining stuff to us and not treating us like the morons we really were when we started. Helg Deller in Germany, who's not here, got a lot of stuff done with getting the kernel to bootload, to actually load, and a few things about interrupts. I know he made a little bit of work for Philip, but in the end, he's contributed quite a bit. Jason Eckert has now gone to work for Cygnus on PaRisk development tools, and he got started on the bootloader. Travis Melheiser gave me the first 715, so if it weren't for him listening in on that food court saying, oh, I have a box for you, none of this would have started as quickly, I think. Martin Peterson for guiding us a lot with HPUX development, or HPUX setup, and a few different code things, and telling us how the systems actually worked under HPUX, which we didn't know. Philip Rumpf has written the majority of the code of interrupts. He's starting a virtual memory, and a lot of things like head.s he's worked a lot on. Matt Wilcox has a miscellany of things where he's really our transportation specialist. I'm not sure what he's going to be sneaking across the border this time. Everyone at HP has really helped us out a lot. We were in Cupertino in March, and we were walking in the halls, and we'd be introduced to people we really didn't know before. And as soon as they heard our names, they said, oh, you're doing Linux for PRX? That's so cool. How can I help? What do you want from me? And there's never been any criticism from anyone within HP about the work we're doing. Even the HPUX guys, there doesn't seem to be any sort of hostility that has existed with in other companies like IRIX at SGI or Solaris within Sun, certainly at the beginning. There's been a lot of other developers who have done little portions of code. I know I'm missing them, and I'm sorry. So, the demo. Where do I get started here? Let me start by flipping to another window and get rid of that.
While you're doing that, why do you suppose PaRisk is the last machine?
The question was, why is PaRisk the last machine that we're targeting or that has been addressed? There's a few different reasons for this, I think. The first one is that there hasn't been hardware specifications out for it. There haven't been public hardware specifications for it, and it wasn't until people asked that they actually did something about it. Yes, there were. The way that Linux for SGI got started was this guy by the name of Dave Miller got a job from this other guy called Larry McVoy, who worked at SGI at the time. It was, I think, a bit of a joke. It wasn't expected to actually produce anything. But the work that Dave Miller did there on things like Ethernet drivers, eventually that code got merged into IRIX. So the whole arrangement worked out quite well. And at that point, SGI sort of got the ball rolling and gave other developers outside of SGI hardware and docs and things like that. So really, SGI did get a lot of, did release documentation for it, though perhaps not in sort of a medium we really wanted. But if you look at things like the Macintosh, no docs at all, got everything working, and the reason is that there were just enough of them out there. There are more Macs out there than there are PA-RISC boxes. And the other thing is that people actually have those at home. PA-RISC tends to be something that you would find on people's desks at work. You would not find them in their basement, or you know, there's not many kids that use HPUX these days. So it tends not to be a home kind of machine, but, unless you're like me. But what's that?
I say the same thing about Spark.
The hardware documentation in the start for Spark was a little bit better off, though. And part of it is also just good luck, or bad luck, I suppose. They all had to roll out in some sort of order, and this happened to be the last one. There can be something said that HP has only just started releasing a lot of documentation. I think really that's most of it.
It's also the price point. Like the PA-RISC implementations up to now have always been high-end servers.
Yeah.
And then there's the presence in academia. HP has always been weak in academia, right? Compared to
that. Let me just repeat those points. Chris's point was that the price point of them, you know, doesn't make it a great box for home, and is very difficult for developers to get their hands on. And also, there hasn't been a lot of HPs in academia, unlike Sun and Apple, actually, which have traditionally had good sales within schools. So those are I guess reasons why. Let me get this started. I'm just going to pull up a chair if I can. We tested this last night at Warp, so if it doesn't nail, then... Great. Okay, so I'll explain what I'm doing here. Be quiet. I have the PA-RISC box, Martin. I have a PA-RISC box here, and I have a serial console going to my notebook. And everything that's on the serial port I should be able to see in the Minicom console here. I'm just going to power it. Oh, that was HPUX I was running, so I shouldn't have just powered down like that. You'll notice it sounds a bit like a jet engine. So I used to have this at home, not many feet away from my bed. It was I always had to power it down at night, or I wouldn't be able to sleep. It's even worse with the fan, with the case off here. It did work. You guys did well. Okay. So I used to have it with the case off, and then the fans were even louder. So I thought, okay, there's plenty of cooling in this place. I'll just unplug a couple of the fans. You do that, and then the whole system is intelligent enough and says, don't screw with me, and it shuts down. So I guess HP knows their hardware a bit better than I do. So what I'm at here is I'm actually at a PDC loading prompt. This is just a boot ROM, and it asks you what you want to load. Martin has set it up in a way which I've never seen before, where it actually just asks you what you want to do. And you can do some cute little things. Like I can just search for all the boot devices that are available. You can see two disks, and the last one is LAN. So what I'm going to do is boot using bootp and TFTP, and I'm going to use my server, or my notebook, as the server for that. It should be all set up. Cross your fingers. So I'm going to boot P2, and what P2 is the second boot. I'm not going to get into what that is because I'm not really sure. So it's booting, and we're still in PDC now. That's printing this. All right, there it is. Yay, it worked. I'll scroll back and tell you what this is all about. Okay. Oh no, I can't. Oh yeah, I can suspend. We'll go back and I'll go over things. Oh, what's that? I didn't know that worked. So here you can. This is still the boot ROM up here. I'm assuming you can see my pointer. And what it's doing is it's boot peeing off to be able to get its own IP address, which you see there. You find out the server IP, which is my notebook, which is .1.68, which I'd actually never seen before. You can see that.
If you got this as an extra one, you can actually wire the phone and
right click.
Okay, why can't I click that? Oh, oh, that. Can someone get Miguel in here and get him to fix that? And then Courier, Adobe? Okay. That's probably what I need to see. I'll just scroll through it like this. Yeah, I'm cut off on this on my side too. Let's go down to 18. You guys aren't in a rush, are you? Preference. Yeah, you got to see the most important stuff anyway. Okay, so where was I? Here you can see the boot P output. This is still within IODC, the boot loader thing, and then it's hard booting. I think the hard soft thing is random, but then you can actually see the bootstrap code itself. It's non-interactive because this is the version that's grafted into the kernel, so you can ask it which bootloader to, which kernel to load and such. What we're going to do there is at some point we're going to take that code back out of the kernel and make a real bootloader with the somewhat corny name of Hilo, just like Silo, Milo, Hilo, Pilo, Lilo, Milo, the other Milo, things like that. There's two Milos, which is interesting. It's written by Halleck and Jason. You can see when it was built, which was yesterday. Actually, the time is in fact correct. It was much later than that. You can see it reading the parameters, which is actually faked. And then you see it actually loading the PA-RIS kernel. So what it's done is we make a boot image within the kernel that has the bootstrap code at the start, and then some PA-RIS code to actually use PDC to load the rest of the file off of the disk, tape, TFTP, whatever. It's done very well in PDC, very easy to do. We just load that into memory, and then at some point we jump in. And you can see that it's identified it as a SOM kernel built on HPUX, right? And it identifies where things are within it. Then it actually jumps to the kernel at this hard-coded address. Jumps in, and then we're really in the kernel. And it says the kernel started. And then it starts identifying stuff, and some of this is just a sanity check to make sure that, you know, it couldn't possibly be making up that it's 180 megahertz PA-RISC machine, right? Because it really is. We've tested 120 meg. So it actually starts querying the system for a few things. Figures out where memory is in the system. These are still with PDC calls. How much memory there is, where it starts, things like that. Then you'll notice this line, and you should recognize this because this is just the Linux banner and represents the first part where we're actually running the base of a kernel. Do you guys know how much time I have left? 15? That's good. And then it actually, the command line is in fact hard-coded at this point. I've never understood what this is for, so I'm going to skip that. Then get into some more complex identification stuff. If you go into an i386, well, actually any modern Linux kernel, and look in a file called /proc, was it CPU info, you can see all sorts of information about your CPU. So we've actually generated all that, and you can see it here. So this is processor 0. So in multiprocessor systems, you can see the same thing for CPU 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Vendors HP, I think that's actually hard-coded, so we're cheating there. It tells you what version of PA-RISC it is and what revision. Then it identifies the model, which is really quite interesting.
Are you still picking some of this up from PDC?
It's all from PDC. PDC, glorious thing. Oh my God, what was that? Hold on, I just screwed the whole thing up. Yeah, I'll just get it again. What's your question about PDC? Mm-hmm. Okay, I. Let me just explain the question as I understand it. I'm back. I've just rebooted, so let me just start the boot again here. BL brings up to mind other things. So. I think the question was, can you actually modify PDC? And it comes because I guess you had a problem with PDC at some point, and their solution to it was to bring in some custom software to be able to modify it. None of the documents I have read have ever suggested on how to actually change PDC. You could probably infer it from the documents, in fact. PDC obviously is some sort of EEPROM. I always thought it was a PROM. I had never known that you could actually write to it. That sits on the hardware. So I guess there is some sort of undocumented method of writing to it. HP has never released that, and quite frankly, it doesn't really seem to be a problem. If we have a problem with our kernel having problems with certain things in PDC, we can always change our kernel to suit it. Lord knows there's enough workarounds for broken hardware in other versions of the kernel, so that's nothing new. I'll go back and go through a few different other things here. So you can see the model, and actually this is... I think that's hard-coded. No, that's actually in PDC. And then we have this little lookup thing, this little lookup table. Okay, what you do is you query for H version, S version. You look up in this table that I typed in a bus trip on my way from Montreal. And it actually is just an index that relates all the different numbers to our real name. And that was like the 700-page document we got from HP with every single bit of hardware they'd ever produced. Included is the code name for it, which is unclear if HP meant to release that. Not a big deal. But at some point we said to HP, oh, hey, we know these machines are called Staccato. And they said, how do you know that? It identifies stuff about shadow registers and a little bit more detail about it. Actually goes in and tells you exactly what CPU it is. Velociraptor, for instance, I've never heard of before. I'm not sure that that's... That was intended to be released. Not a big deal, though. More things. Identifies the instruction and data cache sizes. Some little bits about how many TLB entries there are. Occurs to me that a document I wrote was just wrong. A few other things like that. After that, it tries to load the DNO device. It's all of this code here. So it's by Alan and me. And you can see it trying to allocate an IRQ and failing. But it does identify the version correctly, which is really interesting. We've obviously got some problems, right? I can't allocate IRQ and then IRQ1, so we've got to work on that. Yeah, the KMIM alloc is an indication of a problem. And after that, we use the interval timer. There's a lot of stuff you don't see output for, but it's already set up interruptions and the interval timer. And at this point, it actually goes and calibrates the delay loop, which is a pretty significant step in all of this. So we get just about 240 boga MIPS out of this. Philip has been really concerned that that's not high enough, but we could text edit it in, I suppose. 4,324 boga MIPS. It's bogus anyway. Identifies how much memory, where it is, and then gets the POSIX conformance testing. And after that, we put this cute little spinny thing. Just so it didn't look like it had died completely. It's sitting in the idle loop right now. So we still have stuff with scheduler to do.
How much of this stuff do you think you have to change or throw away when you actually get off?
Nothing. The question was, how much of this are we going to have to modify or redo once we get ELF32 implemented and stuff from Cygnus for ELF64, et cetera? Nothing, because the kernel is actually, you need to compile in some sort of object format. The reason that we're using SOM is because we have those build tools. The fact that it is SOM is almost irrelevant. There's a couple of places where it matters, but not many. Having an ELF kernel itself, which is what runs on pretty much every other architecture, there's a couple of things you need to tweak, but really nothing significant. The only time then this is really going to come into play is your build, the set of build tools you have to use, and when you actually have to run an executable. Now, the build tools, you know, we've talked about that on end, and the executable, well, we're not quite there yet. So what's going to happen is we're going to get to a prompt before we get L32 implemented. Yeah, because we're sort of like a couple of weeks away from being at a prompt. So don't hold us to it. You could hold us to it if you pay us. We are going to have to go back and redo some of that work, but honestly, user land stuff is so easy in comparison to this that it's just going to be a matter of rebuilding. I see ELF32 as being the largest problem in all of this, second only maybe to the MMU. So this is what's interesting about this architecture in comparison to other ones, and that's that really we're used to always having a great ELF implementation and it working everywhere, even if you don't have like a symbol versioning like StrongArm hasn't had until recently, or MIPS hasn't, and it's run beautifully without those things. There was for a long time, Alpha never had, could never handle shared symbols properly and things like that. And we've overcome those over time. But in this case, we really have nothing to work from for an executable object loading format. So it's quite a bit different. It's unique in that way. So we're kind of ahead in some ways because we've got all this PDC stuff, which has saved us, you know, really months of work of kind of poking around in the dark until you happen to flip the right bit to turn lights on. So in that way, it's been really good. But on the other side, we do have all these problems with ELF. And looking at the time, let's see, we've really been developing for, let's say, 4 or 5 months, really hardcore, actually producing some code. And we've spent, I think, about 2 of those wasted on trying to get development tools going, messing around with broken ELF32, really trying to get cross-compilers going that we ended up chucking all that work. All it was really a big waste. So the problems were not exactly in the places we expected. Think of how much we're learning? Oh, yeah. Yep, every day. That's what I was thinking last night at 3 a.m. So that's the end of the talk. I think I had, that's a bit weird. I'm going to skip that slide quickly. Well, that's the real slide. Oh, my God. Okay, well, I will take questions. I'm not quite sure what happened there. I'll take questions. There's a few questions I won't answer, though, and that's anything to do with memory management. If you want to ask me anything like that, I'm going to make up an answer. But I'm happy to answer any questions about PRS Linux. No one has anything. Yeah. I'll repeat the question. The question is, once we get all this sorted out with ELF32, are we going to be able to cross-compile or build natively with GCC and the linker under HPUX? Well, yeah, absolutely. Now, some of this is that really ELF32 isn't going to be implemented anywhere but on PRS Linux. The specification exists in a document, but has never been implemented anywhere. So it's not going to offer you binary compatibility with HPUX or anything like that. It's only the ELF64, and if we actually have the start of a SOM loader, that's going to be able to help you run HPUX binaries. However, you know, it's all the stuff that Cygnus releases are always as cross-compilers. So you're always going to be able to cross-compile from your Mac Linux over to PRS Linux or HPUX, whatever. Yeah, binary compatibility is a very important thing. So we're going to start by having the basis of a SOM loader to be able to run executables. Once we leap into 64-bit or 64-bit work, we are going to once we leap into 64-bit stuff, we will do 64-bit ELF, and then we're going to be able to run HPUX executables as well. And we're setting up our system calls in such a way that should be possible. Some system call stuff was just done yesterday. So should be able to do it. There's been a lot of people really interested in that, and the first day that we were at this trade show in California and talking about it, and some guy comes up to me and says, this stuff is great. When can I run Oracle on it binary emulation or loading their L64 format? So all of that's a bit of a dream right now, but we are planning stuff in such a way that you will be able to do that. And there's a lot of people who have custom HPX applications, and so the intention is that they should be able to run them under PRS Linux as well, in the binary format. Of course, rebuilding is always... Yeah, there's a lot of shared libraries, but if you already own a copy of HPUX, then you can just use those, you're licensed to use those libraries, so it shouldn't be a problem. Certainly plenty of people do that on Solaris and things like that, so it should be possible. But that's a ways away, and really being able to run HPUX applications isn't a big goal, you know. Right now I'm more concerned about getting to a prompt where I can type ls and have it do something or die or whatever. What other questions are there?
What do you intend to do about graphics?
Graphics are interesting. To start, nothing. We're going to be able to use a console on the screen. Some implementations of this hardware use very custom graphics controllers. HP has not said one way or the other what they're going to do about that. If they're going to release a documentation for it, it sounds like, and I'm using this only from things released publicly from HP, that they're a little bit unclear on how they're going to handle this. If they, in fact, want to release the documentation for those graphics processors, or if they want to, you know, fund someone to do, like, Xi Graphics or something like that to do binary-only releases of an X server. We'll see. On the other hand, there are some implementations that use graphics controllers that we do know, like the BT series is on the 712s and things like that. So we're not quite sure at this point.
Write to the console, though, you're using the FBCon stuff?
To be able to write to the console right now, you don't actually need FBCon. PDC does that. So we have text terminal natively, which is a lot easier than things like Indy or Spark. What else? Going once, going twice. What's that?
How big is the size of
it? Oh, it's huge. It's huge because it doesn't really matter how big it is. It compiles a lot of stuff into the kernel right now that we really don't need. Let's see. There you go. 600, a bit more than 600K. A lot of it is code that is never actually run. So the fact that it boots and does what it does is really what we're trying to show, not saying, oh, look, it's a kernel in under 10K or something. So we're going to have to go back and backtrack and do other optimizations later on, though. Oh, that's true. That's a good point. We don't have the uncompression code in there yet. So. It's tiny in comparison to one of those, though, I'll tell you that. Nope. A little bit. So, yeah, it'll be smaller. HPUX is really, really has a very large kernel, though. I'm not quite sure, megabytes, though. So, I mean, that's easy to beat, though. I don't know any Linux kernel that's that big on any processors. I mean, obviously, HPUX has a lot of stuff in it that we don't, so, and the other way around. I don't know, like comparing apples and oranges.
Are you going to be able to run, do you think you plan on eventually being able to run the ELF32 binaries that you generate for PA11 on a PA20 processor?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, absolutely, and there's no reason you can't do that. That's the way that Spark works. That's the way that Spark works, because Spark, there's a 64-bit implementation and a 32-bit, and the way that it works in distributions is that the majority of the executables are actually 32-bit ELF, just run on a 64-bit processor. With SOM, yes, with SOM executables, not with ELF, though. So that's not going to be a problem, and we will have all the code for that. So it should be pretty simple to do. We have day jobs.
Chris and Alex are actually independently wealthy.
Independently wealthy. We inherited it all from our parents. No. The development for this is actually done by developers worldwide, and no one has ever been paid to do PA-RISC Linux development, except for someone who does it and gets paid by a completely separate company to do this. So none of it's funded by HPE, none of the development effort itself. There's no coding done on paid time. It's done in exactly the same way that the original Linux kernels were. Kind of organizationally, the Puffin Group is a consulting company with offices a couple blocks over, and we just act as sort of advisors to HP on how to handle all this Linux stuff. HP really understands their hardware. We really understand Linux. So having a company that HP can talk to, I think, has really facilitated things. It also means that, in sort of making some of these decisions, HP has to discuss some proprietary information. So by having a company that can sign NDAs and have a sort of a formal company relationship, it's possible for us to guide this a little bit further. But at the same time, the development itself works like just like any other true open source development. We have public CVS trees and regular releases, and you can take the release of the day, build it yourself. It's very open, and in that way, it's working a lot better than a lot of the other other ports like SGI, which was have the limited documentation releases, and Macintosh, which has none, and that kind of thing. So having hardware vendor support is really, really good. It's really accelerated things. If you look at the progress that we've made in comparison to other ports, it's just fantastically quick. It's a lot quicker than most of the other new architectures. So what are the questions? Oh, don't be shy. That's it. Okay. Thanks so much for coming.